This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. While rescue operations continue along the Gulf Coast areas affected by Hurricane Katrina, hundreds, possibly thousands of bodies lay in streets, houses, and floodwaters. Eventually, those bodies will have to be identified. My guest, Robert Shaler, directed the four-year effort to identify the remains from the World Trade Center attack. There he faced a similar task, since the remains were so badly damaged he had to rely on DNA profiles to establish their identities. Shaler was director of forensic biology at the New York City Office of the Medical Examiner. He's also the author of a forthcoming book, Who They Were, Inside the World Trade Center Study, the Unprecedented Effort to Identify the Missing. I spoke to Robert Shaler this morning about the coming task of identifying the victims of Hurricane Katrina. Well, Robert Shaler, welcome to Fresh Air. There are many bodies waiting to be retrieved in New Orleans. We don't know how many. What special challenges does it present that so many bodies will have been immersed in water for days, weeks even?
The water per se shouldn't affect the ability to make the identifications through DNA testing. The problem is going to be these will probably be unrecognizable, so you won't be able to do a visual examination and get an identification that way. The temperature of the water, which is warm, and the humidity and heat in the area down there is going to increase or accelerate the decomposition of the bodies, which will, of course, affect the DNA. And so the people who do the DNA testing are going to be dealing with degrading or deteriorating DNA. Another problem with the identification process will be that the personal effects of the people who died won't be available. We used toothbrushes and biopsies and pap smears and hairbrushes and razors in the World Trade Center to get a DNA profile of the people who died. That probably or most likely won't be available for most of the people who died because of the storm.
Just to clarify, what you're saying then is that when you have someone you know is missing, you would go to their home and retrieve something which would have a piece of DNA, some hair, a fingernail.
That's correct.
In this case, because many died in their homes which are destroyed, that's not available.
That's correct. So the way you do the identification then, if you don't have dental records, which might also be missing, and if you don't have medical records, which might be missing, you're going to have to rely on something that we call kinship analysis, which is much like a paternity test. That means you have to collect samples from living relatives. And the problem here is that you have to know that, in fact, that they are living relatives, that they are biological relatives of the missing person. So this complicates the identification process a little bit. Some of this can be helped, perhaps, by making sure that where bodies are collected, that the information where these bodies are collected is written down somewhere or recorded, so that maybe there's like a street address. Apparently there was a nursing home down there where they took 140 bodies out yesterday, and they should be able to get information about the people who were in that nursing home and help with that identification process. But this is what we call an open system, where we don't know how many died and we don't have a manifest of the people who died. Very similar to the World Trade Center work. We didn't know who died and we did not have a manifest of them. An airplane crash is a little different. You have a manifest of who died.
Yeah. You have experience as a forensic scientist, and there are some other issues that those who are retrieving bodies are going to have to confront. One of them is that some of these victims may be murder victims, even sexual assault victims. How does that affect the way you recover and handle bodies?
Well, you're still going to recover them the same way. There'll have to be an autopsy done on every body to just make sure that you know how that person died. You cannot assume, as you pointed out, that they died, that they drowned, or they died from exposure. There will be sexual assault victims, murder victims, and people like that. So you'll be looking for ventilating wounds or blunt force trauma wounds, which might be difficult to sort out from a homicide because there's going to be probably people were beat up pretty badly and bounced around. So there might be blunt force trauma injuries on some of these people who died.
This is, of course, complicated by the massive rescue operations that have been underway and then eventually the reconstruction effort. How should these bodies be handled and stored pending identification?
Well, they should be refrigerated. With the World Trade Center work, we had refrigerated tractor trailers that were donated to us. I mean, they came from UPS and Ben and Jerry's and others. Companies donated these refrigerated tractor trailers. We had 18 of them. There'll be more required for this, of course. And, you know, that's how you have to store them.
You wrote in your book that one lesson of your experience identifying the remains of September 11th victims is that mass fatalities are all about families. What did you mean? What did you mean by that?
Well, the families are the most important part of this. The people who died tragically are dead, but families want their loved ones back. They want to be able to grieve properly. They want to be able to say goodbye in their own way, and they want to be able to bury their loved ones in places where they want to be, where they can go back and see them. And the overwhelming thing that I learned at the World Trade Center and what I wrote in my book was that these families, the only thing that they were concerned about was getting their loved ones back. And during the process of getting their loved ones back, all they wanted from us was to know the truth. Whether the truth hurt them or didn't, they wanted to know the truth of what we were doing and where we were in the process and what they could expect and whether or not they even expect to get their loved ones back. So the other thing they wanted to know was, were we going to continue working? We had to continue working and eventually let them know that there was a stopping point or a pausing point, as Dr. Charles Hirst, the chief medical examiner, likes to say.
How would you handle family members who say that they want to come and look at existing remains to see if they can identify someone? In this case of New Orleans, there will be whole bodies, although, as you said, probably terribly decomposed.
Yeah, most likely these will be fairly unrecognizable. And that's what happened in the tsunami. The bodies there were decomposing rapidly, and they became unrecognizable to the families. And so making identification requires something other than being able to see somebody. But my recommendation is to let the families do what they want to do. We let the families come in to be with the remains, and we only allowed them to see the remains if they wanted to. We didn't encourage it because it's not a pretty sight. And in the World Trade Center work, oftentimes, most of the time, the remains were just pieces. They were not intact bodies.
Now you mentioned that visual identification is not likely, and
yes.
Medical and dental records may, in some cases, be missing,
yes.
Which leaves us with DNA identification. Now, I think most people would assume that getting a DNA profile would be fairly easy from a body, even in an advanced state of decomposition, since, you know, it's retrieved from even dead cells like hair. Will it be easy to get DNA profiles of the bodies?
It depends upon how decomposed these bodies are. Certainly the tissue that will yield the best quality DNA will be the bones. So to even attempt to do a waste of time and money to analyze tissue samples, it just might be just that, a waste of time and money. So getting bone samples is critical. Doing duplicate testing is critical, so there should probably be two samples taken from each body, as long as that body's intact. The DNA profile that would be obtained doing testing bone is probably fairly complicated, but it's straightforward testing, and most laboratories, forensic laboratories, probably know how to do it. But the DNA profile that you get out of the bones is going to be dependent upon how degraded the DNA is. And that could be anywhere from fairly complete DNA profiles to fairly incomplete DNA profiles, which we call partial profiles. And this leads to a whole host of other scientific problems where the interpretation of these profiles can be very sticky at times. And this is a process thing that we learned and that I detailed in my book, the interpretation of these kinds of profiles. It was a very difficult thing for us to have to go through, and we had to learn a whole new process of interpretation in order to get them right.
I don't know if this takes us too deeply into the science, but I think a lot of us would be surprised to hear that DNA in the bones would be degraded. Why does that happen?
Well, the body around the bones is being degraded, so it's eventually going to get to the bones as well. The bones should provide the best source of DNA, and if we're lucky, it won't be badly degraded. And if it's not badly degraded, then then we should be able to make the identifications. At least the DNA profiles will be there to allow us to make the identifications.
So, yeah.
If they're degraded, then you're going to have, then they're going to have to think about other things that have to be done. One other test would be mitochondrial DNA. That'll help you show that this particular person came from a particular family, and that may help as well.
Mitochondrial DNA, meaning what?
This is DNA. The body has two different kinds of DNA, or cells have two different kinds of DNA. One is in the nucleus of the cell, which is the typical DNA we think about when we talk about doing paternity tests, and the kinds of DNA that we usually analyze for identifying bodies or doing forensic testing, such as in a homicide or rape case. But the other DNA is found inside the cells in organelles called mitochondria. And it is a separate circular DNA, which is smaller than the DNA found in the nucleus of the cell. But it's also a little hardier and lasts longer. And that could very well be because it's trapped inside these mitochondria, which deteriorates slower than the rest of the cell.
But that kind of DNA gives a slightly less certain identification?
That's true. And when you have this large a number of missing people, the mitochondrial DNA is not going to be sufficiently unique to make an identification. But it can help you pinpoint families. So if you have DNA from a family and you suspect that this person came from this family, then you can use mitochondrial DNA to help show that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Robert Shaler. He is the former director of forensic biology at the New York City Office of the Chief Medical Examiner, and he led the effort to identify remains at the World Trade Center attacks on September 11th. He's also the author of a forthcoming book, Who They Were, Inside the World Trade Center DNA Story, the Unprecedented Effort to Identify the Missing. Somebody has to organize those who believe they have missing relatives, get them somewhere, and get DNA samples from them,
yes,
and assemble and store that into a database with some kind of way to compare it. That sounds
like a pretty
big job.
Pretty big job. You know, you have a lot of people, and one of the problems is that the people are all over the place now. You have a bunch of people in the Astrodome in Houston. It would not be a bad idea to get in there and start collecting samples once you have everything in place to do that. You want somebody there who understands what kinship analysis is and the meaning of the different biological relationships and how that relates to a DNA test. One of the problems we had in the World Trade Center work is that this process was given to police officers who don't understand that process, and they didn't always collect the proper sample, and we had to go back to the families and collect additional samples, which prolonged the whole process for another couple of years.
What kind of mistakes would they make?
Well, for example, they would say that in one family we had the father gave a DNA sample. Well, a single parent giving a DNA sample is not enough to make an identification, but the police officer thought it was fine. He, in fact, really should have collected samples from the mother and also the children, brothers and sisters of the missing person. So when the father called us and wanted to know why we hadn't made the identification yet, when I looked up the information and saw that the only DNA sample we had on record was his, I had to advise him that he had to get the rest of his family to give DNA samples. And this prolonged the process. We had recovered his son's remains in November 2001, or maybe it was October, but we didn't make the identification till middle of 2002. We could have made it earlier.
Have you spoken to officials from New Orleans about any of these issues?
I will be speaking to some today.
Is there a particular piece of advice you would give them as they confront this challenge?
Yes. I think one of the things that you have to restrain yourself from being impulsive and rushing into this. There's plenty of time. It's going to be a slow recovery process. It's going to take time. The samples can be stored and not deteriorate and put it in a place where they won't deteriorate any further. And once you get all your processes in place, then start to make the identifications. It's the overwhelming impulse is to get the DNA testing done as fast as possible and make the identifications. That's really okay if you have a couple of samples to do, but there's going to be thousands of samples to do. And each of these should be tested twice. There should be redundant testing to ensure the samples aren't mixed up. So you want to take your time. You want to make sure your processes, your tracking, your ability to track samples, your ability to match DNA profiles, and your ability to make identifications is all in place before you even start. That way you're going to minimize your errors. You're going to minimize the headaches that you have in the future.
And in a world with a round-the-clock news cycle and hundreds, if not thousands, of grieving relatives, there's going to be a lot of pressure to act quickly.
Once the world realizes that this is a DNA effort, then there's going to be an immense pressure on these people down there to get this DNA testing done fast. And there will be continual questions. Why is DNA taking so long? Or how does the DNA process work? It's a mysterious process to people. And when you tell somebody that the DNA made the identification, they're taking that information on a great deal of faith when they recover their loved ones and bury that person. And so the processes have to be put in place first. You have to take your time and do it properly. Otherwise, you're going to end up with a multitude of mistakes that you're just going to have to go back and correct.
It's possible you could misidentify a body and give someone the wrong remains?
Sure it is. If you mix up a sample, you may very well send the wrong body to the wrong family, and that's why you want to do redundant testing if possible.
You spent so long on the World Trade Center effort. I mean, it lasted until April of this year, as I understand.
Yes.
Are there particular lessons that you learned and would want to share about dealing with these families?
Dealing with the families?
Yeah.
The first lesson to learn is you tell them the truth. You don't hide information from them. If they ask a question, you give them an honest answer. I'm not saying you tell them all the gory details, but you certainly don't want to purposely mislead them. So it's critical because you want the families on your side. If the families are against you, then you've done nothing but create a big headache for yourself. In addition to that, you're being disingenuous to the families. And these are the people who you have to think of at this time. There's a number of issues, and they're talking about the economics and insurance companies getting money out of this. But the bottom line to my way of thinking is the families are the most important. These are the people you have to be concerned with at this time.
In your project identifying remains at the World Trade Center, there was a large team had to be assembled, and they all had to deal with, I suspect, some pretty troubling emotional issues. I'm wondering how you dealt with that. I mean, was there training that helped people?
Well, we had no training for that. It's something that you deal with on your own. And the one thing about forensic scientists is that we deal with sort of like the seedy side of life, so we see a lot of troubling things, but for the most part, we don't get involved with families. When you start getting involved with families and you're dealing with their emotions and their angst, then after a while, it's only going to affect you, and you have to either walk away from it for a period of time or learn to deal with it. Otherwise, it's going to affect you emotionally as well, and it'll probably affect you for the rest of your life.
Do you think that's something that people in New Orleans should be planning for, training or counseling for folks who have to deal with these issues?
Yeah, they should be working on that now. They should have counselors there. I mean, we had counselors at the World Trade Center in the medical examiner's office. We could go down and get a massage if we wanted to. There were religious people there. There were rabbis, priests, chaplains and whatnot there to counsel people and to console people. And it happened. People would go down and take advantage of this. It was critical. Plus, we had the government-funded people who specialize in stress-related things.
You don't want to try and take all this on your own.
You can't.
Robert Shaler directed the 4-year effort to identify remains at the site of the World Trade Center attack. His new book is Who They Were, Inside the World Trade Center Study, the Unprecedented Effort to Identify the Missing. We'll close this half hour with music from Dr. John. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.